This episode series was done in partnership with and sponsored by Showtime.
When you look at how it was done, it was extraordinary. I mean, we went through the tunnels. You look at the precision of the operation. It was truly extraordinary and unusual and almost impossible to duplicate. But we want to find out exactly what happened. And one of the big questions is, where did the tools come from?
So what did you say? You immediately yelled something at him.
Well, I first came around the side of the building at my house, and I saw the shadow running away from it. So I went around to see who they were, because I want to know who was in my backyard. So I go look at him, and I see him. I ask him, "What the hell are you doing in my yard? Get the hell out of here." And he was like, "Sorry, I didn't know where I was. I'm on the wrong street."
Now, once you know who it was that you saw, what do you think?
Lucky to be alive, man. Like, they could have done anything. Like, they could have jacked my car. And, you know, you never know. I mean, they're criminals, so.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today from across the pond,
live from London, Laura Richards. I'm former criminal behavioral analyst from New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti, casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes and the minds that write limited series about those crimes.
Yeah, there you go. And today, again, we're lucky enough to have two amazing guests.
I'm Brett Johnson, co-writer and co-creator of the Showtime limited series Escape at Dannemora.
I'm Michael Tolkien, co-writer, co-creator of Showtime's limited series Escape at Dannemora.
Well, thank you again for coming back and joining us so we could talk even more about this amazing series.
I wanted to ask, you know, what was the hardest part then for you in telling this story and putting it together?
The hardest part really is when you have, and I won't, you know, we won't give away exactly how we solved this problem, but when you have a prison break and there's guys on the run, there's a David and Goliath aspect to it that's, you know, impossible to ignore. And just like if there's a car chase, you know, and the cops are chasing the person, and while you may know in theory that the person probably did a bad thing to be chased by the police, you're not watching what they did. You're watching one guy against 100 guys, or in this case, you had up to 1,500, you know, law enforcement officials from several different agencies chasing these two guys. They were on the run for 21 days and 23 days, respectively. Matt didn't make it as long as Sweat did. But we were very concerned with not turning these guys into folk heroes, because that's what happens with this stuff. I mean, in some ways, you know, we watched every Prison Break film ever made, I think, the ones that we could find. And the most beloved one, I would probably say, is Shawshank Redemption. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more you look at the Shawshank Redemption, and obviously that's based on a fictional short story, the Shawshank Redemption in some ways is like a fairy tale. I mean, it's almost like a Disney film. It's an innocent man transcending the bonds of injustice through escaping. And we always kind of said from the beginning that this is the exact opposite of Shawshank Redemption. These guys were both murderers. In the case of Richard Matt, he had murdered multiple people that we know of. And
Sweat killed a cop.
Yeah, and Sweat killed a cop. And, you know, these are not also, you know, I would say that a lot of times in films that depict serious violence, you know, not to name any directors in particular, but you can take a great amount of entertainment value, even if it's based on a true story, because it's a bad guy killing another bad guy. Well, this isn't like that either, because the people they killed weren't bad guys. So you can't watch, you know, this actor beating up another guy and going, yeah, kill him, kill him.
And the murders are really brutal.
Yeah, the murders are really brutal. And so that was something that we were very concerned about and fought for in a lot of different ways to counteract that, you know, in a way that really works.
But in spite of that, you do create this great tension as we are waiting for them to get out and all things that, you know, talk about sweat. He sweated. I mean, his effort to get out was tenacious. And I know we'll get into that when we cover. Yeah. But, you know, this is a fascinating behavior that these guys had.
Well, when you think about it, nobody wants to be in prison. Nobody. And when you are somebody who has sort of literally gotten away with murder at some point in your life, you feel like you don't deserve to be in prison. And so a lot of what some prisoners do the entire time they're there is fantasize about and make these plans of trying to get out. And it happens sometimes. It's actually successful a number of times. I mean, I've worked a number of cases when I was on the FBI's bank robbery and violent crime squad of people who broke out of prison that we went after. But that said, and I think you sort of alluded to it earlier, particularly this prison and the massive size of it and the monolithic nature of it is a very difficult one to get out of. And because of that, they really needed to be master manipulators in order to actually accomplish this escape. And that tells you something about it. You mentioned earlier, for example, that when you talked about Eric, you said he was an actor and a talented writer. And obviously, we know Matt is a very talented artist. Obviously, these guys were really good at things. And many times, they use these skills. Because people think sort of monster predators. They don't look like us. They can't be the people that we know. And so they don't expect to be taken advantage of by people who actually are communicative, that who have, you know, this level of charisma or ability to manipulate people. And unfortunately, that makes them even more dangerous offenders. I mean, if they all look like serial killers, people would stay away from them. But when they look like Benicio del Toro, they may not. And so they're able to manipulate people with their looks, with their charisma, with their verbal skills, and with their artistic abilities.
Mm-hmm. And with their ability to flirt. You know, I mean, this guy, Richard Matt, is an incredibly gifted. In fact, we had seen, you know, his portraits, and he did mostly celebrities, and it's such an amazing juxtaposition when you look up the crimes that he committed, and then you just see Julia Roberts, Hillary Clinton, Oprah Winfrey. He did a portrait of Oprah Winfrey that in the corner says, "Thank you, Oprah, you changed so many lives." And we taught, and corrections officers who knew him said he actually, it wasn't just for show. He watched Oprah Winfrey every single day in his cell.
Wow.
And we actually have him quote Oprah Winfrey in a couple of moments in the show.
Really?
Some of them you got to be a real Oprah fanatic to catch, because he doesn't say it from Oprah.
Right.
You know, many psychopaths, part of psychopathy is having charm and being able to manipulate. And, you know, what we see, and I think it's an interesting dynamic of what's going on, is who's manipulating who, who's, you know, really controlling who. Certainly Tilly seems to be very susceptible and kind of a people pleaser type character. And then you've got those individuals who use others for their, and bend the rules to, and bend other people to their own will. We see that on display. And I've got to say, Benicio del Toro, I mean, the way that he characterizes Matt, you know, it's a real kind of menacing charm about him. And part of it is obviously the way that he looks, but also just the characterization aspect. Serial killers don't all look a certain way, and police killers, you know, they all look very different. But the tools that they use when there is coercive control and charm, charm disarms. And, you know, the more you're complimentary to people and you lavish attention on them, well, it increases your likability. And they use, you know, all of those tools to enable, well, to get Tilly to aid and abet and allow them to escape from a maximum security facility.
Also, along the lines of the manipulation, you know, it's a good time to talk about Tilly, because she is a character where if you listen to what she says, and she also went on the Today Show, and her version of events... You know, it's tricky when you're doing this stuff, because you only have the people talking who are alive. And these people are strongly incentivized and in many cases to not tell the truth.
Mm.
And her version of events was basically that she helped them to escape because they told her that if she didn't help them escape, they would kill her husband.
They would escape anyway.
Well, no, they said that they said that if she didn't give them, she snuck hacksaw blades and frozen hamburger meat, And she said to the judge that if she didn't do that, that they were going to kill her husband. And Lyle Mitchell, her husband, was also an employee of the prison. And the judge immediately pointed out the complete absurdity of that. Because even if you could believe for a second that these guys could kill Lyle within the prison walls, he didn't work in the tailor shop with them. And every single day they're leaving and going home and can go to the sheriff and tell him what's happening. And they would be protected unless she believed that the sheriff was working for Richard Matt outside of the prison. This is when we get very lucky to have the Inspector General's report, because she documents and interviews many people and uncovers contradictions and things like that. But I guess the point is just that you'd think that the story was just that they are manipulating her. But there's moments in which you almost wonder, is it the other way around?
Well, isn't there? I mean, I don't know if this is, I don't want to get into a spoiler or anything, but I mean, what was their plan once they got out?
Most of the stuff that happened in the story is on Wikipedia. So, you know,
it's more the how, not the
what. It's more about the how. I mean, we tell you right up front, you know, these guys escaped. You know, there's no suspect. I mean, I remember when we were first talking about this saying, if all we've got going for us story-wise is will they escape or not, we're pretty much screwed. Because if we should be able to tell you right up front, they make it out and it should still be interesting, because the real dramas are more about the relationships between these people. But the plan was for the three of them to run away together, basically. The thing that is so much more, I think, just for myself, more engaging about this story than any other prison break story I've ever read about or watched is her. Because she grew up in this town. She was in a marriage that she was unhappy with. She was in a town that she was unhappy with. She was in a job that she was unhappy with. And she very clearly wanted to get out. She wanted to go somewhere. And even just being a participant in the escape in and of itself was an escape for her, because it was a secret. She's going into the back room. She's sneaking them hack subleads and frozen hamburger meat. It's like, I'm being a spy. And those elements, to me, when you're watching a bunch of men, however well it's written, however well it's directed, however well it's photographed, escaping, you're watching just these are inmates and they're trying to get out. Are they going to do it or not? But with her character, suddenly you're, at least for me, you're thinking, well, what is it that I want to get out of? Am I happy in my job? Am I happy where I live? And suddenly it becomes kind of deeper and more poignant and more universal, hopefully.
Right, but also wasn't part of their plan, once they got out, to kill Lyle. So to say to the judge, I did this to protect Lyle so they could get out and kill Lyle, is just completely absurd. I'm sorry, I can't buy that.
Well, as Catherine Leahy Scott, the Inspector General, lays out in her report, and she was not prosecuted for conspiracy to murder Lyle. Maybe it was because there wasn't enough evidence, but Catherine Leahy Scott makes a very clear point in her report that she doesn't know whether or not Tilly wanted to kill her husband. But what she does know is that Tilly admits that the plan was, when they got out, she was supposed to pick them up. The plan was to go kill her husband. That's the plan, she says, that they told her. Well, if that's true, and she knew that and continued, not only didn't tell anybody, but continued to help them escape and didn't tell the authorities, even though she didn't go and pick them up, she doesn't know what's going to happen. And not only that, frankly, legally speaking, she's incredibly lucky that they didn't kill anyone once they did get out.
Just ask her for a flashlight. We need a light. How about some of those little eyeglasses with lights on the end?
No. Fuck no.
Inmate Swat, can you help me get some spools out of the machine room?
Yes, Mrs. Mitchell.
Hey, just ask her.
Tell her it's for painting at night.
Character, though, I mean, if it, Patricia Arquette has studied Tilly, and I have to say I did watch the interviews, you know, when she gave some interviews, but also at sentencing, you know, her sentencing, I thought was very interesting, because She is a people pleaser, and she comes across as somebody who's won over by the smallest gesture. And therefore, in terms of her personality profiling, she's somebody who shouldn't really be working in that environment. The fact that she's unhappy, and yes, people do look for outs, and then you have these charming and manipulative individuals who zero in on those things where anybody can be malleable. But she just strikes me as a very quiet and very malleable person who is a people pleaser. So, and that's why, you know, when you back and forth, she was in the position of trust. That's why I think it's a very interesting characterization, because if you flip it on its head and she were a male working in that environment, it's a female prison, you would ask, you know, maybe some different questions. So the gender part does play a role. And I think, you know, how she's been characterized by Patricia Arquette is extremely interesting. And even when she's being interviewed, you know, she was compliant and she did cooperate. Yes, she has another version, but she does seem to me to be somebody who is very malleable and would not be suitable on a personality profile to working in that kind of environment for that very reason.
Isn't it kind of a safe fantasy for her to indulge herself in, because it was going to take years to get out and it got accelerated by certain things? But, you know, she could sort of languish in this fantasy, right?
Yeah, well, somewhat. I mean, but she was actively participating with them in these affairs and giving them the tools to get out. But also, Laura, I think this is a recurrent theme of small town girl wants to break out. I mean, she wants to break out of the small town. They want to break out of the prison. They can help each other. I mean, it's a symbiotic relationship. And I think she took advantage of that opportunity, the excitement that you mentioned, the affair. She felt more special. And the fact is that she is just as complicit as they are in the escape, and would have been legally responsible had there been any felony murders. In fact, in some states, she could be convicted of a felony murder if the convicts got killed, you know, when they get killed, you know?
Right. Oh, well, absolutely. Right. I mean, I look, Richard Matt would be alive today if it were not for Tilly.
Right. So
that's a fact, because probably, unless he got himself killed in prison, you could definitely argue that point. Now, I don't think you're going to get a whole lot of people lining up on Richard Matt's side of that.
No,
you know, courthouse, but
it happens all the time where people who are involved in a conspiracy to commit a felony, and somebody dies, even if it's one of the conspirators, that the other co-conspirators could be prosecuted for murder. So she's lucky she wasn't prosecuted for murder. But I do think that it's kind of ironic that she wanted to break out of this small town. They wanted to break out of this huge prison. And without each other, they couldn't have done either. And this series will show us what actually happened.
It really is one of those just once in a blue moon stories, because they couldn't have done it without her. And Matt and Sweat couldn't have done it without each other either, because when you read about what each of them did and when you see what each of them did, very early on in the escape, David Sweat, who is played by Paul Dano, was cut off from Tilly. So he's got no interaction with her, and she's the person bringing them stuff. So without Richard Matt doing that, you've got nothing.
Right.
But at the same time, David Sweat had like this mind of an engineer and was absolutely brilliant when it came time to do all of the cutting. And, you know, he was ingenious.
He built the air conditioner.
He gets into a place where it's too hot, and he built the makeshift air conditioner where he's hot wiring a live circuit to a fan that he found and stripping wires and, you know, to cut through the back of his cell wall. He, like, you know, broke these, we made it exactly as he described. He broke these hacksaw blades and then took a nail clipper and pressed that down for leverage and then wrapped that whole thing with tape. I mean, there's so many things that are like out of MacGyver.
Yeah.
And forget any of the ingenuity. I don't think Richard Matt was ready to do the work. I mean, the amount of hours that this guy was going down there, and Richard Matt is basically like, hey, man, I'm the mastermind. You're the worker bee.
This is not in the show, but what do you think drew them together in the first place? I mean, we kind of know how they all collided in the sewing room with Tilly, but what did they have a relationship?
What drew Matt and Sweat together?
Yes.
They met painting.
Painting.
Matt was a great painter, and Sweat asked him if he could teach him how to paint.
So it was the perfect storm. I mean, in terms of how they, you know, start this kind of bromance in a way.
Because Matt was an artist, and was using oil paints without giving it away right now, But there's a line that goes directly from his using oil paints to his discovering a way out.
And do they believe that power tools were actually used or not? I know there's still a lot of question marks about that.
No power tools were used, but there was initial reporting that there were because the cuts were so impressive.
I thought it was a blade.
You know, in fact, one of the really fascinating things when you go up to Dannemora in Plattsburgh, it was just huge. It rocked the entire community. For 3 weeks, everybody was on edge. I mean, and by the way, this area, it's 5 miles from Canada. And like Canada, people don't lock their doors. And I heard, you know, one of the great anecdotes that we wish we could have got in there was a lot of instances of people going to locksmiths because they were finally locking their doors.
And they didn't have keys.
And they didn't have a key to their own house. So the locksmith's business was booming. People were just buying guns left and right. I mean, we met a guy at the bar the very first time we went up there who was wearing his Vietnam fatigues, and he said, let me tell you something, if those guys would have come into my backyard, they would have never found him. And I'd have a Richard Madden and a David Sweat over my fireplace right now. So, you know, but one of the really interesting things is there are a lot of conspiracy theories up there about what really happened. And I think what really happened is what we depict. You know, and this is based on a lot of thinking about this stuff and really, you know, testing each one of the theories against the facts that we know. But, I mean, there's people who think, oh, it was a disgruntled maintenance employee. One theory was that there was always a way out down there and that they just found it. But it's completely impossible because when you know the way out, you know that it's something that could have never been there until the time that they made it. But I guess it's just really interesting because there's so much speculation. Whenever, I don't know, it reminds me of JFK a little bit, just because when something so big happens,
a lot of
and
mythology.
It jolts you so much, almost like you can't believe it was just what happened. There has to be a deeper story.
But there was another co-conspirator, so, you know, the correction officer, Gene, I mean, you do depict him in that he had this relationship with Matt as well, you know, and he used him for certain things as well. So, I don't know, there were maybe other fingers reaching out to help them.
Gene Palmer, who is played by David Morris, if it weren't for Gene Palmer, they would have never got out. However, he maintains, and we believe, that he never knew that there was an attempt to escape. The reason why Gene was so crucial was because Gene worked on the prison block where Matt and Sweat lived. And Tilly could not give them the frozen hamburger meat where the hacksaw blades were in. She couldn't get, you're not allowed to bring meat from your place of employment, the tailor shop, into the cell. But Gene Palmer had this job called the escort guard, who's kind of like, you know, on a chessboard, he's kind of like the queen. He can move anywhere he wants. Mm. And so he brought them the frozen hamburger meat. And according to him, he just thought it was frozen hamburger meat. Now, he shouldn't have been giving them any hamburger meat anyway. But I don't think he knew that there was hacksaw blades in there. And the thing that's so interesting about Gene Palmer, too, is he was like an art collector. When the police finally descended upon him, he had, I think, 11 Richard Matt paintings and like 8 David Sweat paintings. And one of the most perplexing pieces of evidence we ever came across was that he burnt the Richard Matt ones and buried the David Sweat ones.
Really?
What does that say, you guys? Laura,
wow.
Jim?
There's a line
that he burned them to try to get rid of them?
There is a line that's in the trailer, and it's a line that goes straight to the research where we see Gene being interviewed, and he said, well, I knew with the meat we were in the gray area.
Right out of the transcript.
These guys are dangerous. These guys are two guys that are as dangerous as you're going to get.
Martin Horn is a former commissioner of the New York City Department of Corrections, an expert on what happens inside prisons.
It's entirely possible over the years these guys have been in prison that they worked on some sort of a maintenance detail because prisons like Clinton use the prisoners to help to maintain the prison, everything from painting the walls to fixing the leaks to rewiring an electrical socket. And so they may well have actually been in the pipe chase area that everybody seems to be so fascinated with.
So before we wrap up, a couple things I wanted to get into my sort of thing.
Lisa may be a casting director, but she focuses not only on casting, but on wallpaper. Okay, well, wallpaper. Always wallpaper, right?
No, it's blouses as well, yes. Jim. It's blouses and wallpaper.
Okay, wardrobe and wallpaper.
Well, I just really try to take in everything, and I try to look at everything like a decision. I'm a big David Fincher fan, and I know that he does that a lot in his work. And so I was noticing that this color appears an extraordinary amount.
Our listeners can't actually see this,
I actually kind of can't really.
It's sort of a hunter green
It's like a bluish gray, and it is everywhere. This is what the jumpsuits that the guys wear are. The walls are this color. Tilly's bedroom is this color. The signage
I'd like to say that Brett and I fought over this. We drove everybody insane over it.
But I see something, you know, so, and it gives everything a very eerie. I mean, it's just a very interesting color. Even the cabinets. Once I started seeing it, I couldn't stop seeing it. So, and the music you used. I mean, this music
Let's deal with this first. Let's deal with the color.
If you look at the background, the cells are painted this color, and even the background where Catherine Leahy is interviewing Tilly, half the wall is white, and then half is this color. Anyway. I get the look from your faces that this is not a choice, but maybe your production designer, you know, maybe it was on their minds to create this as a mood.
The cells are exactly the color that they are in real life. The cells are actually kind of like that green, though, aren't they?
They pull out of this, but they're almost a shade of this.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, that would be a collaboration. Anything with the color was probably a collaboration between Ben, Jessica Lee Gagne, our director of photography, and Mark Ricker, the production designer.
Because most cells, we shoot in prisons all the time. They're not that color, and most jumpsuits are not that color. But even every spool of thread in the sewing room was that color anyway. I got obsessed with
And also, by the way, Tilly, you know, she wears a black and white striped jail outfit, which we hadn't seen, you know, since, you know, cartoons from the 1950s. That's the real Clinton County prison stripe. So we went with the accuracy, but maybe.
And then my other thing is the music. You use a lot of diegetic music, which is, you know, practical music that's really coming out of something. You think it's an underscore, but it's really somebody's music in their ears. Yeah. And then you play the entire song of Take Me to the Pilot, which must have cost you like a gazillion dollars. So I just loved all of the music.
I agree. The music was amazing.
Yeah, there's a song that's at the very end of the final episode that we found early on, and it became sort of like one of the two musical touchstones for us, which is, I won't spoil what it is, but it's early 70s folk rock, which Take Me to the Pilot is too. And there's kind of two musical sounds, in addition to the incredible score by Ed Schirmer. There's that. There's like 1967 to 1978 folk rock. Mm-hmm. And then the third music is Tilly's music.
Yeah.
And this came from a real piece of research. We met a guy who was a corrections officer who had to meet us in secrecy. We met him in like a secret room of a hotel. He didn't want to be known. I mean, they were, you know, the corrections officers.
Very early on in the research.
The report had just come out. They were told to not talk to any journalists or certainly not filmmakers. And this guy told us that he worked in the shop with her and she was very kept to herself. She was very private. And then he didn't work in there for a few months. And then he went back and it was after the escape plot had already begun. And he said he knew something had changed because she wasn't sitting up on her podium all the time. And she started listening to 95.5 XXX. And we said, well, what's 95.5 XXX? And he said, it's a top 40 station. Immediately, we went, and this music is not what any of us normally listen to. It's the type of music that's usually in a show like The OC with a very attractive person doing sit-ups or something.
Very poppy.
But when we started listening to it, we actually went and we found every single top 40 song from like December 2014 until June 2015. We made a playlist on Spotify, which we all shared. We text messaged each other ideas. And that became the sort of other thread of musically in the show. And I think it actually really works as a way to express her character's need to get out,
right?
Need to escape, because you think of, you know, Nick Jonas, you think of young people, whatever, listening to it. A lot of people that are listening to Nick Jonas are people like Tilly in the middle of nowhere in a car that's broken in a snowstorm. Listening to...
Well, the husband wants to listen to the news.
Right, right, right.
Yes.
The last piece of music I want to comment on is they do a test run of The Escape. You know, Sweat goes down and runs the maze of The Escape. And there's music that starts out as like plink, 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 and then starts to grow and grow, and it becomes a drum, and it becomes so evocative as he's pushing to go through. And I just thought that was just a genius use of music.
Well, I would just say that those dinks and a lot of those noises are actually real sound effects, really recorded. I think some of those are the chisel hitting the concrete wall. And Ed Schirmer, who's absolutely brilliant and who's composed mostly for films, came on this project with us. And him and Ben have known each other a long time. And I thought one of the most brilliant things that he's been doing is incorporating real sound effects of real prison sounds into the music and using the ham, you know, the sledgehammer hitting the chisel like you'd use, a xylophone or whatever, instrument it would be.
Well, that's pretty amazing that you picked up on that. So, Michael and Brett, do you have any last things that you want to talk to us about before we wrap up this episode?
Everybody should watch the show.
There you go.
Well, I think that our listeners will definitely watch the show.
Yeah, definitely.
We are so thrilled that we are part of this project.
It is an amazing, thrilling thing.
Well, we're both really big podcasters and really big fans of yours. And this is, to me, if I was watching the show, this would be almost as exciting every week to, you know, listen to as watching the show. And we hope that it, you know, we're very excited to see what you guys have cooked up.
Okay,
great.
Okay.
We can't wait. Well, we want to thank you, Brett and Michael, for coming in. And we can't wait to watch Escape at Dannemora, a Showtime original series.
I just, you know, think you've done a great job. And just thank you for your time. But yeah, I really enjoyed reading the scripts and seeing the show as well. I think it's definitely Emmy worthy, and Patricia Arquette is just incredible.
Thank you so much for you guys being here and talking to us. And we're all really excited about this amazing new series on Showtime, Escape at Dannemora. Till next time, thank you for listening.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.